Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Cairo is Khaled El-Gindi, who is a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And you're in Egypt. Did you go there to vote?
No, I didn't. I didn't come here to vote. I actually voted at the embassy before I left. I came here to, to observe the electoral process and to touch base with some of the different actors in the process.
And the results seem somewhat polarized. Between, at least the preliminary results indicate the runoff is going to be between Hosni Mubarak's last prime minister, Ahmed Shafiq, a former fighter pilot and colleague of Mubarak's, and a Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mohamed Morsi. The general sense is that, from what I understand, is that you've got Shafiq, who's considered a Falul, a member of the remnants of the old autocratic regime, and the Brotherhood candidate representing the two poles, but the majority in the middle basically split the vote, did they not? The Hamdine's Sahab Sabahi, the socialist, and the more moderate Islamist.
That's exactly right. I think your description is exactly right on. You had typically... You might expect to see a rejection of the two polar ends of the political spectrum, but we actually saw a movement towards the two poles. I think it's a reflection of the situation in Egypt and the very difficult, problematic transition that the military rulers have devised for Egypt, which has really been botched from the beginning. And has sown the seed, has exacerbated social and political tensions, has helped to destabilize the political environment, and of course, during the transition, because it's taken so long, the instability has worsened the economy, and so in that context, it's not that surprising that people would be more attracted to. To the polar ends of the political spectrum, as opposed to the various shades of gray that might come to the fore in a normal political environment.
So the fact that Hamdine Sabahi, the socialist, and the one who championed the poor, he made a surprisingly strong showing, and he was third. Only 700,000 votes away from Shafiq. He's appealing. When you said, Khaled El-Gindi, that the military botched this, I'm wondering whether that was that mendacity or incompetence?
I mean, I think the military is, despite the perception that they've tried to promote, has political interests. They are not a neutral actor. They have economic and political interests that they have been trying to preserve. And their management of the transition has been guided first and foremost by the goal of preserving those interests. Along the way, they've tried to manipulate and engineer the transition in a way that is more suitable to their interests. They've tried to play one group off of another. They've classic divide and rule type of strategy. So I don't think they intended to have the outcome that we have today. It wasn't all sort of a part of a master plan, but it is the result of a combination of them trying to engineer the process, even though it didn't always work out the way they wanted, and incompetence. Certainly, they're not skilled in the arts of governance, for sure.
Well, I spoke on the second day of the elections, Khalid El-Gindi, again a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. I spoke on the second day of the elections with an Egyptian sociologist at American University, and he said that that he in sort of informal field work, if you will, that a lot of poor people that he talked to that they would normally vote for the Brotherhood were voting against the Brotherhood, and that there was quite a great deal of alarm in Egypt about the amount of money that has poured in from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. Both in the early elections that brought out the Salafists out from nowhere, and have poured into the Salafists and the Brotherhood, clearly an indication that Saudi Arabia is trying to buy the vote.
Well, this is one of the botched aspects of this process, and it's been botched not just by the managers of the process, the military, but also by the various actors. Who I think acted according to narrow parochial interests, as opposed to broader ones, and one of the problems with this and previous elections is that you have no real campaign finance laws. There are no rules and regulations about disclosing your sources of funding. And expenditures and so on for campaigns like you do in most functional democracies. And so you're going into, Egypt is going from a period of 30 years of being depoliticized into a suddenly hyper-politicized environment, essentially with no rules. And it's, of course, it's impossible to know at this point. We know anecdotally that there is money coming in. We don't know how much money was spent. We don't even know. The only real regulation there is, as far as election law, is that there's a spending cap. I believe it was £10 million for the presidential campaigns. But there's no way to know what enforcement mechanism is there, and there's no way to know how much people actually spent or how much the campaigns actually spent. So this is one of the problems, this lack of transparency, this lack of checks and balances and rules for governing an electoral process. So it's one of the reasons why a lot of people feel that even though the election was competitive, in that there wasn't, at least on a massive scale, there wasn't the kind of blatant ballot box stuffing and rigging that the Mubarak regime engaged in, and you had competitive elections that nobody knew the outcome to beforehand. Just because those elections were competitive doesn't mean that they were free and fair.
Well, Jimmy Carter, the former president, said that the process was genuinely acceptable, but he says that the final aggregation of the national results are not transparent. So that's sort of a bit like Stalin's old adage, it doesn't matter who votes, but who counts the vote.
I mean, right, and this is one of the problems, where there were some aspects of the process that were transparent, but there were others that were not. And there are lots of different reports, and it's not clear now. There are several challenges now to the Election Commission to various alleged violations. It's not clear, if any of them will amount to anything or if they'll result in any sort of, not clear what the implications are of those. But, again, it speaks to the problem of having an electoral process without proper mechanisms and guidelines in place to preserve the full integrity of the process. So the election result is useful. I think I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand as being somehow totally illegitimate. But there are questions and there certainly are problems. But one interesting thing that it does tell us, especially when you compare it to the parliamentary elections is people, the Egyptian electorate is not voting on an ideological basis. So when people looked at the outcome of the parliamentary elections, where Islamists, something like 60% of the voters elected an Islamist candidate, and there was this sense of an Islamist tide taking over their country, we now see a majority of Egyptians voting against Islamist candidates. And so their vote isn't based on an ideological affiliation primarily. And I think we also see in the point that you mentioned about the Brotherhood facing some setbacks, there was opposition. There was a generalized opposition, disappointment in the Brotherhood. There was a fear of primarily, I think, of having power concentrated all in the hands of one party, where they would control the parliament and the president, and by extension of their control of the parliament, they would also control the constitution writing process. So there was a reluctance, I think, on the part of most Egyptians to hand that kind of concentrated power over to one group. There's also a disappointment in their performance, and a sense of, you know, that there was a lot of talk from the Brotherhood, and they didn't deliver. Some of it is fair, some of it is not fair. Obviously, you can't change the situation dramatically in just 4 months. But some of it, I think, also is reasonable to hold the Brotherhood accountable for the priorities that they made and for their inability to work with other political groups.
Again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's talking to us from Cairo, Egypt. He's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution and previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. So, Khaled El-Gindi, surely in terms of the work that you've done with the Palestinian leadership, there's a great deal of anxiety being expressed in Israel about these elections and who will be president. And already one of the people in the runoff, the Air Force, former Air Force General, Ahmed Shafiq, proudly boasted the other day on television that he shot down an Israeli plane, I guess, was that in the Yom Kippur War?
And I believe so, yeah.
Yes. So tell us how things are shaping up there in terms of what kind of changes there might be. Because my understanding is that a recent poll indicated that about 50%, it was about 50-50 in terms of Egypt's public's polling on whether or not they wanted to continue the Camp David Accords.
This is an interesting point. I know it's a major point of concern, certainly for Israel, but also for the United States, close ally of Israel. The important thing to note is, one, in a campaign environment, in a pre-election environment, there's always going to be kind of a populist tendency, and so it's not unusual, you know, given the public opinion here is decidedly pro-Palestinian, overwhelmingly pro-Palestinian across the board. There's a very solid kind of consensus in the Egyptian public about that, and not a lot of sympathy towards Israel. And so it's not unusual that you would see that presidential candidates are trying to outdo one another in terms of who is more pro-Palestinian or more anti-Israeli than the other. The reality is that there's a fairly solid political consensus across the political spectrum, Islamists and non-Islamists, left and right, with regard to upholding Egypt's obligations under the peace treaty with Israel. And in some cases, actually, you might find that some of the leftist groups are actually more radical than the Muslim Brotherhood is on this particular point. But the Brotherhood and other Islamists have said that, you know, we will uphold Egypt's treaty obligations, but we want to do it in a way that protects Egypt's interests as well as defends Palestinian rights. So, and there's a solid consensus on that view. We don't yet know what that will translate into down the road, So there will be changes, but I think they won't be sort of strategic, earth-shattering changes. There'll be changes in the tenor, certainly, and in the style. The already cold peace between Egypt and Israel will become colder. But the other point that I think is important to keep in mind is that this transition is ongoing. It's not something that will end when the president is sworn in on July 1st. The current military rulers will continue to control large aspects of decision-making of the government, including national security policy, defense policy, certainly, the intelligence apparatus, and to the extent that all of those relate to foreign policy, which they all do, particularly when it comes to Israel. Israel is not just a foreign policy issue, but the whole situation with regard to Israel and the Palestinians and the Gaza Strip and the situation in the Sinai, this is a national security situation. So for the most part, I think we won't see any real changes, even after a new government comes to power, a new president is sworn in, because those will still be in the hands of the current rulers, as they have been for the past several decades. So the transition will be gradual, and it will not be, I think, all that dramatic.
Well, just in closing, Khaled El-Gindi, on the Israeli side, of course, there's a new government now, the unity government, with a substantial majority. So Israel is no longer beset by coalition politics in terms of being shackled in terms of making decisions. And the new government, of course, got rid of Shas, the ultra-Orthodox hard-line wing. Netanyahu has said that this means that we're free now to try and bring about peace with the Palestinians. A lot of people, of course, are deeply skeptical about Netanyahu, and the assumption has been that one of the reasons that we keep talking about an attack on Iran is as long as Netanyahu is talking about attacking Iran, nobody's talking about the Palestinians, and they become a kind of invisible people. Do you think that changes in Egypt are going to force the Israeli government to get more serious?
Not necessarily. I think the changes in Egypt have probably instilled more of a much more conservative mindset in Israel. There's a lot more fear of the unknown and fear of Egypt taking a harder stance or worse. And so that will make them less inclined to be forthcoming in any kind of a peace process. But I think you're right. I think the priority for Israel right now, this government, as well as the previous one, is still Iran. Iran is the number one strategic issue for Israel, and there hasn't been any real shift with regard to the Palestinians, either in terms of the substance of what they might be willing to offer or in the process. The process remains exactly the same, which is non-existent. There is no such thing as the Middle East peace process. There hasn't been for many years. There are kind of theatrical displays every now and again to pretend that there's some kind of a diplomatic process going on, but in fact, everybody knows that it's completely vacuous and non-existent, and I don't expect that to change in the near future. If anything, Israel will become less forthcoming, and the fact that for now Palestine is relatively quiet, you know, despite all the upheaval around the region, you know, Palestinians aren't engaged in another intifada or a mass uprising either against the occupation or against their own leadership. There are regular demonstrations against the wall and settlements and things like that on a day-to-day basis, but there isn't yet a critical mass or a mass movement. And so as long as Palestine is quiet and Iran is the priority and the region is still fluid and uncertain, events in Syria, events in Egypt, I don't see any real peace process emerging in that sort of environment. That's not to say I don't think there are real opportunities. I happen to think that there are opportunities, but there is not the political will either in Israel or in Washington to pursue those.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Khaled El-Gindi.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking to Khaled El-Gindi, who is in Cairo, Egypt. He's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and he previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.